This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
Setiap orang punya impian. Impian itu yang bisa meneruskan kehidupan ini. Impian Dinda adalah untuk mendapatkan cinta sejati.
Jika patah sayap Raja Wali, bertungkat jua ganda kemari.
Adinda anggap sebagai janji.
Hello everyone, welcome to Popcorn Culture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, with me as always Sharmila Ganesan and Arvind Yuvaraj. And I'm quite excited about our throwback today actually, because it is, we don't often do local films, and this is maybe one of the biggest in the 2000s anyway. And we are throwing back to 2004's Puteri Gunung Ledang.
Yes, Puteri Gunung Ledang recently became available on Netflix. And I think for many people, it will be the first chance since it came out in its cinematic release in 2004 to rewatch this. And, you know, 16 years later is quite an interesting time to rewatch, especially a local film, because in terms of even just in terms of what it is, it's a sort of epic fantasy. It merges the mythologies of the Puteri Gunung Ledang with the legends of Hang Tuah. Visually, there's so much. And I was very curious to see how it would hold up so many years later. Not much has been attempted in the genre anyway since then. And I'm really glad to say that it was such a fun, not just fun, it was a really nice revisit.
I can't believe the movie is like 16 years old. That's the
right?
First thing.
Yeah,
I can't believe it's been 16 years since Puteri Gunung Ledang came out. I was in Form 5 when it first released. And I remember like when it came out, it was super popular. Everyone was talking about it. And the soundtrack, I think, was even more popular than the film. So Asmara Dana was like on the radio and it was everywhere. If you turned on stuff like NTV7 and all that, it would be on like literally all the time. Really enjoyed watching it. And it also made me feel bad for not going and seeing it when it was out.
So usually at this point, I start summarizing, right? And give you guys the deets on who the director was, who the actors are. Before I get into that, though, I did want to ask you, because Sharmila mentioned genre. What genre is this film? How would you categorize it? Because I think that it sort of is masquerading as one thing, but is actually another. And I'll say why. Because I feel as if it is masquerading as a fantasy blockbuster, but is in fact a romantic tone poem. So that's where I land.
You know, I think that's exactly it. Because I was also younger when this came out, and it was marketed as Malaysia's fantasy epic or whatever, right? And it is that. Like, it looks like that. It feels like that at some point. But you're right that watching it now as an adult, there's something so meditative and melancholy and beautiful about it that I don't think I'd call it that anymore. I can't categorize it, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think in all the best ways, it takes the best things about a fantasy film experience, but it feels a lot more like a very Nusantara mythology.
Yeah, so when it started out, I thought it was going to be a straightforward drama. And then it sort of picks up, and then you realize that it has a lot of like quote-unquote magic involved, quote-unquote stuff that is only in mythology involved, which was nice, I guess. So it's a nice mix, and it is kind of, I don't know how true it is to the actual legend. I know that there are some liberties taken for dramatic effect and stuff, but I like that they didn't omit the magical elements a lot in this film. Like, they kept it in, but it was not the sort of dominating factor of the whole movie. There's not a lot of CGI work. There is CGI work, but it's not like big fantasy epic CGI.
So as we said, right, this is from 2004. It was directed by Saw Thiong-hin, and it stars as the eponymous princess, Tiara Jacquelina, and M. Nasir as Hang Tuah.
Yes.
And I think as far as the deviations from the legends go. So for people who are familiar with the legend, and for those who aren't, you know, it basically tells the story of a princess who appears in some ways on the top of a mountain, Gunung Ledang, and is then courted by the Malaccan Sultan, and she sets out a list of 7 demands, you know, to accept the proposal, and that is more or less the original tale, right?
And it there's no Hang Tua in the original tale.
Well, he's supposed to be a lot older.
Yes.
So I think that it's a conflation of two huge archetypical stories in the Malaysian landscape. So that of Putri Gunung Ledang, one of our most famous princess stories, I guess. And then Hang Tua, one of our most famous warriors and one of our, you know, the guy who populates so many stories. And it kind of mashes them up together, and then Romeo and Juliet defies it.
Yes, and it also it adds in the element of history in many ways, because it's about Malacca and Majapahit. So in this case, the princess is originally a princess from Majapahit, and there are all of these like political conflicts and you know, issues that are happening as a background to why she ends up meeting Hang Tua in the first place, why she ends up being betrothed to the king, and all of it to say it works very, very well. Of course, since the movie came out, it's been adapted into a hugely successful stage musical. It actually almost single-handedly pioneered this renewed wave of big-budget Istana Budaya-style Malay musicals here in Malaysia. So if you've watched the musicals, and like me, if you had more memories of the musical, you'll remember it being very larger than life, you know, beautifully, grandly staged, very dramatic. And none of that is a bad thing. But I like what you said, Arvin, about the fact that everything doesn't feel epic. And watching this film, it's such a great study of how to create a sense of epic without necessarily needing to do the CGI or having the huge sprawling sets. Instead focusing on what you can achieve, how you can achieve a sense of the grand with not that much.
Yeah, but at the same time, the sets are also very grand, like the landscapes and stuff. So I think they shot mostly in Cameron Highlands. So the scenic shots are really nice. The cinematography is like really, really...
The set design is great.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It has like that epic sort of feel. So I think there was a lot of like control, and they knew exactly what they were doing and what they needed to do with the budget they had. And you mentioned like big budget. So I think this was Malaysia's first big budget film. Mm-hmm. Cost them $4 million to make, which was in today's money is about 16 million ringgit, right? So I read somewhere that it didn't make back the money that it put in. So it made something like 2.5 or at most 3 million ringgit, which is kind of a shame. So that's a whole other conversation, right? Like how many people had to go and watch it for it to make back its budget? How many people had to go watch it for it to make a profit? And it's kind of... I mean, it's just a bit of a bummer lah, that, you know, Putri Gunung Ledang couldn't make a profit even with all the effort and all the stars and so much sort of quote-unquote power put into it.
I think that might be a perennial problem with local movies, right? So if anything, it's kind of fascinating to see it going all the way back to what, at least in the last 20 years, is really one of the defining Malaysian blockbusters. To that point about beauty in the set or beauty in the framing, I think... you know, oftentimes maybe we are all trained by our moral textbooks to believe that, you know, everything we do should be to make everyone love our country. That's almost the frame, right? Like everything you do in this world needs to somehow represent you as a Malaysian, represent Malaysia as a country everyone wants to go to. And I think that this movie is such a good example of doing that without actually compromising on a story, a film, on actually doing something, you know, as opposed to just making a piece of film that you're then supposed to go, see, I made this, you know, isn't Malaysia great? Because it's so rich in our mythology, it's so rich in our language, in our history, and it's also done so beautifully. I mean, like, all the scenes at the waterfall, by the jungle, my heart just broke. Not even because of the story, but just because sometimes you see things on a screen and you're like, this is so beautiful.
No, and I completely agree. And maybe the reason why it doesn't feel like a sop to Malaysiana is because it's drawing on a larger idea of the region as well, right? It's got these Indonesian elements. It's got the historical Buddhism and the Hinduism of the region in its decor, in its dance. in the way people move, in its martial arts. And all of that comes together because I love a sense of the Nusantara when it's presented properly. And I think this film manages to get most of it right, not necessarily historically accurate, but to evoke a spirit of it in some way.
And I think the thing that adds to the you're mentioning like beauty, the thing that adds to the beauty of it is the music. So we spoke about M. Nasseh is also behind the music of the film, him and his team. And it has such a, it's a film that was out in 2004 that feels like old school Hollywood from 1950, if that makes sense, the music itself. But then you have a lot of like seruling, you have a lot of like Eastern region sort of music coming in. It's a very, very nice mix. And I think the music helps a lot. If it didn't look epic enough, the music just like solidifies it.
I have one really idiotic gripe that I'll get out of the way now so that we don't have to have it color the rest of the show. And that is, were they flying? Was there some sort of shuttle flight between Majapahit and Malacca back in the day? Because people are appearing with great rapidity.
No, but some of them have magic powers.
Teleport.
Saying they're apparating.
They're apparating. Yes.
Yes, but Putri took a boat over the first time.
That is true. Drama la.
Look, if Game of Thrones can do it, then there's no reason why they can't.
Actually, I blame Game of Thrones for this because, of course, you know, we were all so like involved in cataloging who was where and, yeah, you know, the way that the landscape seemed to shrink and grow. And I think because this is a part of the country that we're very familiar with, I was just like, really? What, you have a ferry? So that was my only gripe. It's out of the way. Thank you very much for putting up with me. We are throwing back today to Putri Gunung Ledang from 2004. We haven't actually touched on the performances, and they're really the beating heart of the film. So we'll get to that after this. Do you remember watching Putri Gunung Ledang back in the day? Have you revisited it recently since it became available on Netflix? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can, of course, also tweet us at BFM Radio.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Sharmila and Arvind. We're throwing it back today to Putri Gunung Ledang from 2004, Malaysia's really first big budget blockbuster. So Tiara Jacquelina as Putri Gunung Ledang, M. Nasir as Hang Tua. Discuss.
I want to first talk about M. Nasir because, again, this is one of those cases where I've watched the musical twice, I think. And so in many ways, Stephen Rahman Hughes' stage version of Hang Tuah has supplanted M. Nasir. And, you know, Stephen is great. He's charming. He's dashing. He can dance. He can sing. So it's lovely to watch on stage. I'd forgotten what a melancholic hero M. Nasir was in this film. And just the world weariness that he brings to the role, at first glance, it feels a little bit like, why are you so stoic? Like, don't you have more to show? But the truth is, it's a very subtle performance, and it really grows on you as the film progresses and as it reaches that sort of heartbreaking end. It's such a great performance. I loved M. Nasir as Hang Tuah.
So the fact that he is sort of like a veteran, or like he is sort of aged in this film, made me want to see films leading up to Putri Gunung Ledang. So Putri Gunung Ledang is kind of like the shared universe, and I wanted to see spin-offs of both of them and how they get to this point.
Oh, like pre-Hang Tuah, like the prequel types. I would sign on for that.
I felt like both characters were very, very interesting, and I wish we would have gotten to see more. Which brings me to another point. I am super keen to check out the theatrical release of this film, because the one that we saw on Netflix is the producer's cut.
Oh, is that so? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so the actual version of the film is 2.5 hours. It's 2 hours and 25 minutes. The one that we see is about an hour and 45 to an hour and something like that. So it was done for the Blu-ray special. It's a producer's cut. I honestly want to see what they cut out.
Also because, so in many ways, I think that the performances are so important. And to that point about cuts, because it's not just M. Nasir who's melancholic. Actually, the central love affair is fundamentally melancholic, intimate, physical, and very quiet. You know, it's kind of expressed very much through body language. There's not an awful lot of conversation. The conversation, you know, is either something that seems to be happening as a melding of the minds in some ways, or as a flashback to conversations that you never really see happen.
Or through dance. Which I love. That's a beautiful sequence. I love that scene.
Especially because you contrast that against the martial arts.
The
Silat,
yeah.
Exactly. And so you're right. I am interested to know whether in the director's cut it's more of this or more of more speaking, you know, more explanation. Because the movie is actually very short on exposition. It doesn't really try very hard to say, and now this is happening, blah, blah, blah. It's very sort of broad strokes. It happens in conversations between counselors and their rulers. And then you have to kind of fill the gaps from there.
You know, we have talked about the Putri, and I think Tiara Jacquelina, who plays this role, it's not an easy role to carry, right? Because on the one hand, you need to be able to play that attractive, beautiful, your classic Eastern princess, if you will. But at the same time, there's a grit to her, but there's also a sense of, I will do whatever I need to get what I want. And I think that's quite admirable. And for a movie that was in 2004, because we talk so much now about empowered female leads and you know, characters having their own agency, I was so surprised to watch how much agency her character has, even till the end. The way she plays that role is incredibly subtle and incredibly interesting to watch.
So my favorite part about Tiara's performance as Gusti Putri is that she's mildly frightening.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and you're not exactly sure what the character is thinking or what she's capable of, because you see these elements of, like we mentioned, the magic, right? So she can do things and you're not sure to what extent that power goes. Like, she can disguise herself, she can shapeshift, she can sort of, like you mentioned, teleport, she can read minds. You know, although she's the lead protagonist, you're like, who exactly is she and what exactly can she do? And my closest comparison to a much newer film is like Maleficent. She has the same sort of, like, you know, that same sort of power and that same sort of like mystique.
I totally agree. I also think, however, that the beauty of it is you believe she is lovelorn, because it's pointed out to her several times in the movie, why are you lowering yourself? Why are you chasing this man? He is below your station. And there are all sorts of questions about that, right? Like, even if you are a powerful woman of a certain status, are you just there for your marriageability to be bartered away as part of a peace deal? But I think the vulnerability of being somebody who saw what she wanted, yes, made a hard decision, yes, but also in some ways did something that princesses don't normally do, which is chase their man, you know, which is chase their man across the strait.
A man who didn't seem to want to reciprocate, to be honest.
Not necessarily, because he's so loyal towards his sultan. So there are, so that combination, I guess, of mystery and magic and slight kind of, what is she capable of, with really true vulnerability as well of, like, I don't know if I'm going to get rejected. That element, I think, was part of what made her so intriguing.
Yes, and I also wanted to add that it's not just the two lead characters that have these kind of complexities and shades of grey, because even if you look at the Sultan, Sultan Mahmud, who's played by Adlin Aman Ramli, or Gusti Adipati, who is the Putri's brother, who is the king of Majapahit, he's played by Alex Komang. You know, both of them, they are sort of in some ways the archetypical villains, but in other ways they're really not. Adipati, for instance, is really just interested in saving his people and feeling betrayed by his sister and sort of trying to figure out what best to do. Even the Sultan isn't really painted as some sort of lusting after the Putri bad guy. He's just someone who doesn't want his honor to be tainted in some way, or his standing in the eyes of the world to be reduced. And all of these are such natural, very gray intentions that I think it really adds to the richness of the story.
I also wanted to say that I'm wondering if streaming services are the natural next step for local films, because this movie is obviously getting like a second life. A lot of people are watching it again. It's at number one. It's been at number one for a few days now on local.
Since it came out, just over the weekend, it's shot to number one.
Yeah, and people like me, people like myself, I didn't go see it in the cinema. I watched it on Netflix, and I'm wondering if this is the natural progression, if they can find more success on things like Netflix or like local streaming services.
I don't know. I mean, it's perfectly possible, and we don't really know what's happening. Even bigger movies, right, are finding homes on streaming services. I guess for me, it's more like I'm hoping people watch this as an example of Malaysian film and want to pay for a ticket the next time that one emerges in the cinemas. Yeah. Because it's a mixed bag, right? On the one hand, I'm happy that our local films are now more widely available should they find homes on streaming services, so that if you miss the sometimes very narrow window, you get to revisit. On the flip side of that, I would like to see people, Malaysians, wanting to like participate in the local film industry by buying tickets as opposed to passively paying for a monthly subscription and happening upon one.
And just to add to that, I want to see more filmmakers taking risks like this, you know, telling stories like this with this sort of all in and let's see what happens. I hope rewatching this now inspires that kind of filmmaking once we are able to go to the cinemas again.
Okay, so we're talking today about Putri Gunung Ledang, which was released back in 2004, directed by Saw Tiong Hin. And yeah, just it's available right now. So if you missed its first run, it's a great time to catch it. Let us know what your thoughts are on Putri Gunung Ledang. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and write to us at movies@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.